Read and hear more about important news and policy issues at ncpolicywatch.com. This is News and Views.
Welcome to News and Views. I'm your host, Rob Schofield. North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein is almost three-quarters of the way through his first term in office, and by any estimation, it's been an extremely busy 3 years. State law deposits a wide array of responsibilities on the Attorney General, from overseeing all state criminal appeals to handling thousands of consumer protection complaints. Now add to this the challenge posed by any number of high-profile national and state-level legal crises, and it would be understandable if Stein found himself overwhelmed. Impressively, though, Stein seems to be handling the onslaught of wide-ranging duties with great aplomb. Recently, the AG joined me in studio for a special extended conversation about his challenging job, the controversy surrounding thousands of untested rape kits, and the devastating opioid crisis that afflicts our state. Well, Attorney General Josh Stein, thanks so much for being with us.
Pleasure always.
So, my goodness, you've come almost to the end of your third year in office. It must seem like you've been there a long, long time at this point. It must feel very natural to be the Attorney General of North Carolina.
Well, it's an honor. It's an honor, one which I just enjoy every day, because the people who work at the Department of Justice are so dedicated and hardworking, and to be able to go and be with them and identify important issues that make a difference in the quality of people's lives and then attack those issues is incredibly rewarding.
I can imagine. Would you say that's the best part of the job? Is there a best part of the job?
I think that's the job.
Yeah.
It is the job, and it is the best part. And the office tries to help and protect people in so many different ways. And people are familiar, probably most typically they think, oh, Attorney General, criminal justice.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
We play a big role in the criminal justice system, of course. We train law enforcement. We analyze crime scene evidence. We handle every criminal appeal in the state, but then we also find issues, whether it's prisoner reentry or pretrial release or the opioid issue, which I've spent a great deal of time on, testing every untested sexual assault kit in the state. So that's a lot of what we do, but we do consumer protection, we do environmental protection, we do taxpayer protection, we protect people's fundamental right to vote. We touch on a whole lot of issues that make a difference in people's lives.
Is there a toughest part of it?
I exist in the executive branch, and we have our independent authority. Obviously, we have to cooperate and partner with the legislature on getting different policy initiatives through, getting our budget through. We had some major hiccups with the legislature, particularly in that first year in 2017, where they slashed my budget by $10 million. I mean, it was pretty devastating. So we've had to deal with that and continue to deal with that to this day. But the legislature has been a partner, whether it's on the opioid epidemic or it's the sexual assault kits. Another bill I've championed is called the Safe Child Act, which is to protect kids from sex abuse wherever they are, whether they're at summer camp, whether they're at Little League, whether they're at church or temple, or whether increasingly as they are online. We've got to do everything we can as adults in the state to keep kids safe from abuse. We are a hair's breadth from getting that bill through. So we find ways to work together even when we disagree.
Well, you've already listed a whole bunch of issues I want to ask you about. Let's talk about this rape kit business. And
yes.
Because I think that's been sort of lingering, and I think people see headlines. Tell us what the deal is with that. It seems like we're finally getting our act together with this incredibly important issue. Your office has taken a lead on that. Talk to us about how we're getting that right.
Yeah, it was a devastating realization. In 2017, I came into the office and I asked the head of the crime lab, I said, how many untested sexual assault kits are there?
Do you mean kits that were used in the process of investigating an alleged crime, right?
What happens is somebody experiences a sexual assault and they go, usually they'll either go straight to the police or they'll go to a hospital.
Right.
And then they will then willingly submit to an hours-long invasive examination in order to produce evidence for the criminal justice system to then seek justice and to put a dangerous person away and to deliver justice to the victim. And those kits would be collected, given to local law enforcement, and they would just sit on the shelves of local law enforcement around the state. And there are some historical reasons why some of the backlog existed, but let me pass beyond that for right now. So I said, how many kits are in these local law enforcement agencies? And my guy couldn't tell me, John Byrd, who is the director of the state crime lab, he couldn't tell me because he said, we keep asking, we've heard from a fraction of them, but they don't respond. And so Billy Richardson with the legislature and some other legislators, we went and talked to them and said, look, we need to have a mandate. They have to give us a count, an inventory. You can't address a problem until you know the scope. So we did that. And at the end of 2017, beginning of 2018, we discovered there were more than 15,000 of these in hundreds of agencies. And that was a devastating realization. The national advocacy group said it was more than any other state in the United States. And so we developed a plan to attack that. And one was to develop a tracking system so that going forward, we would know exactly how many kits there were and where they were in that process. Look, you can track your pizza delivery. You can track your UPS shipment. Once the victim gave over the kit, he or she had no idea what ever happened to it. They didn't know where it was.
It would be incredibly maddening, you can imagine.
And it was.
Frustrating.
I've talked to a number of victims, and it was really emotionally devastating for them. So going forward, we're fixing that. Also, that transparency to know whether it's at the law enforcement agency, is it the lab, that will create accountability on all of us to do a better job, which is good. So now we'll know exactly how many kits there are and where they are. We raised $3 million in grant funds so we could start the outsourcing, and we've already done well over 1,000 of these kits. Went to the legislature last year. They didn't give us anything.
Wouldn't that be something the public would ordinarily fund?
You it
would
is.
Think you shouldn't have to raise money
well,
from grants.
We weren't going to wait, so yeah. We wanted to get started.
Yeah.
But then I do want to thank the legislature because this year they did $6 million, and they imposed a requirement on law enforcement that within 45 days of a reported sexual assault that they forward the kits to the lab. We want to do two things. One, ensure that we eliminate this backlog once and for all. And two, make sure it never develops again. And we're seeing incredible results. Of about the 1,000 we've sent to the lab so far, we've had nearly 200 hits. We've had like an 18% hit rate, which now means cold cases of 20 years ago, 30 years ago, have very hot leads, and law enforcement now needs to go try to find these people and arrest them.
It sounds like sexual predators need to be aware because the attorney general's coming after them.
So we're
thank
coming.
You. Thank you for doing that. The other issue that's just been so dominant in our news, and you've alluded to it previously also, is this horrific opioid crisis that continues to plague our state and our nation, and the numbers just shocking, the number of people we're losing to opioids. You all have made some headway, both going after the companies that have essentially been pushing these drugs on people and at the same time taking steps to get the public to wake up to this crisis and start taking action to address it at the local level. Talk to us about some of what's been going on there.
Well, today, approximately 5 North Carolinians are going to die of an overdose. Yesterday, 5 died of an opioid overdose, and 5 died the day before that, and 5 are going to die tomorrow. It's the deadliest drug epidemic we've ever experienced. It is touching families all across the state in every corner of every demographic. It doesn't ask you, that morphine molecule doesn't say, are you old or young? Are you Democrat or Republican? Are you country or city? It just takes over your brain and it becomes all-consuming. It's horrific. So this is something that came to my attention a lot on the campaign trail in 16 when I was traveling the state and I would meet with policymakers or sheriffs all over the state. And I kept hearing, yeah, the opioid epidemic. And so I came in and made it my top priority. And we've had a very comprehensive strategy to attack it, focusing on prevention. So we pushed a bill called the STOP Act to reduce overprescribing. A legislature passed that unanimously. Very pleased about that. Prescribing of these drugs have dropped 25% in 2 years. So we're starting to see improvement in that regard. There's a public education campaign that we partner with the Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Mandy Cohen called morepowerfulnc.org. And any of your listeners, if you want to learn about it, if you want to know what you can do about it, or if you or your loved one needs help, go to morepowerfulnc.org. It's chock full of useful information. We are advocating on treatment and recovery. The most important thing that the state of North Carolina could do to address this crisis, the single most important thing, if we were serious about this, would just to be say yes to the federal government's offer to return our taxpayers' dollar in the form of Medicaid expansion. Because
really?
Medicaid provides 40% of all treatment dollars for drug addiction in this country. So we have hundreds of thousands of people without health insurance who are thereby not afforded the opportunity to get healthy and well. On the law enforcement side, we've got a great partnership with federal, state, local prosecutors and law enforcement where we've identified a number of gaps in law, policy, and training that we have filled so that they can go after the bad guys. Because there are really awful, these drug traffickers, drug dealers are making millions of dollars peddling poison to people and ruining lives. So they need to be held seriously accountable. But there's also a growing realization among law enforcement that if somebody's crime is their addiction, it's a lot more effective to treat that cause than it is to just keep arresting them, letting them out, and arresting them again. They say, we're not going to arrest ourselves out of this crisis. So there's a lot of great and innovative work being done by law enforcement about trying to get people out of criminal justice and into health care. And then you alluded to the litigation. I'm helping to lead the national multi-state coalition of attorneys general, everyone in the country, Democratic and Republican alike, to go after the drug manufacturers who produce the pill and distributors who ship them from the manufacturers to the pharmacy. And we've reached a framework with the three distributors and two manufacturers, a $48 billion framework, which I liken to we got the ball on the five-yard line, and we got a lot of work to do. Got to finalize details. We've got to get a lot of buy-in by the other states. Got to get a buy-in by the cities and counties. But I feel like we've got an opportunity to bring resolution, which is essential because these companies helped to create this crisis, and they need to help pay to clean it up.
If we were to get North Carolina to get some share of those billions of dollars, what would it likely go toward?
We have essentially a six-page menu of abatement activities, qualified activities. These are things that happen at the local level that make a difference. It could be paying for someone's treatment. It could be the medication-assisted therapy, the drugs for the treatment. It could be paying an EMS to have a post-overdose recovery team go visit somebody to try to connect them to treatment. It could be doing a program in the county jail to deal with people with addiction so they're getting treatment in jail so that when they get out, they can get treatment. Anything that can be done that is being done that needs to be more funded so that we can really help people who are struggling.
We're talking with North Carolina Attorney General Josh Stein. It's a great honor to have him with us here on News and Views, and we've been talking about some of the important topics that he's leading the charge on in our state. Another one that we've heard about recently from your office is the whole conundrum of Facebook and social media and the fact that you're leading an investigation with some other attorneys general into the company's business practices. Talk to us about what's going on there and what your concerns are.
Big tech, it's happened so fast. 20 years ago, did Facebook even exist 20 years ago? I don't think it did. Yeah. Google was just getting started. So the internet didn't exist 25 years ago. So everything has changed, and the internet is the critical infrastructure. That is where the economy is. What we have to ensure that happens, that these companies, which are just massive in scale and dominate the internet, Facebook is the social media site and Google is the search site. And because of their dominance in their respective areas, they control advertisement on social media. They control all of our data. These companies know what you're doing on the internet, even when you're not on their websites. They just have so much information about us. And the concern, it's not illegal to be big.
Sure.
What's illegal under United States antitrust laws is to be big and to use that power to hurt competition. Because when you hurt competition, when you squelch it, you're hurting you and me. You're hurting consumers. And that can affect us in the prices we pay for goods so that maybe the advertising costs of companies we buy from are higher because of what is going on with their dominant position. Or we could pay for it in less quality. And if you have a company that doesn't value privacy because they don't have any meaningful competition, that's a cost to you and me. And so those are the things we're looking at. It's early days. We've just announced an investigation. There's no lawsuit that's been filed. But this is one of the thorniest and most complex issues we're facing as an economy in the United States, in my view.
I think all of us are increasingly aware of it and feel somewhat vulnerable as a result of it. So we would like to have you as our champion on that. Another issue in which you've been involved recently, which is particularly notable here in North Carolina, is the issue of e-cigarettes and vaping and the increasing dangers we seem to be. It was originally, we thought, oh, well, this is a safe, perhaps a more safe alternative to traditional tobacco use. But now, maybe not so, right?
Again, this sort of goes to the speed at which things change in our society, in our economy. Juul, J-U-U-L, for the listeners out there, I'm not talking about jewelry, I'm talking about an e-cigarette company. It did not exist 4 years ago. I mean, it didn't exist. It is now the 800-pound gorilla. And if you have a middle schooler or high schooler or college student, which I do, then you know what I'm talking about. If you don't, you may not even have even heard of this company. But it has taken over high schools. Bathrooms are now called vape rooms. We had achieved as a nation an incredible public health victory from the late 90s to about 5 years ago, driven teen smoking from about 27% to less than 5%. That was a result of that whole tobacco settlement in the late 90s. A lot of public education to young people, helping them understand how dangerous smoking is for their health. So we'd done an incredible thing. Every gain that we fought, every inch of victory we'd achieved has gone. Now more than 30% are using either traditional or e-cigs. 27% of high schoolers are using e-cigs. And it is a more efficient deliverer of nicotine than a cigarette. So kids are getting addicted quicker and more intensely. If you get addicted to Juul, you are 5 times more likely to smoke cigarettes. You are more likely to be addicted to alcohol, to cocaine, methamphetamines, opioids, because you create a neural pathway in a developing teenage brain. A scientist wrote a paper in which he described the teenage brain's susceptibility to addiction as exquisite sensitivity, that because it's forming still. So if you create those pathways, the grooves in your brain, it makes it so that you want to be addicted to everything else. Half the kids who do this don't know there's nicotine in it. They think it's water vapor, flavored water vapor, and it's the flavoring which appeals to them. I sued Juul. I'm the only attorney general in the United States that has sued this company, but I did it because after an extended investigation, we concluded that this company designed the product, they marketed the product, and they sold the product to target young people, including minors. And it has been a wildly successful business venture on their part because they're like a $40 billion company now.
That's in 4 years.
It's astounding.
That is astounding. Boy, we wish you good luck with that. Boy, there's so many other topics I'd like to ask you about. In general, there's this issue I think that your office has been involved with, which is sort of responding to the sort of deregulatory frenzy of the Trump administration when it comes to the Endangered Species Act and other sort of basic environmental protection and consumer protection laws. It seems like the Trump administration is just taking a black marker and erasing everything. And some attorneys general, including you, have sort of been responding to that. What can you do to respond to some of these things that the Trump administration is doing to get rid of just basic environmental and consumer protection laws?
Well, it depends on what the issue is and what the act was. I mean, the president has certain authorities and where he's acting within his authority. It's not a matter of do I agree or disagree, because that's not a basis to bring a lawsuit. When I bring a lawsuit, it's where he's hurting people and he did it in an extra legal fashion, meaning he wasn't in compliance with what he was supposed to do. So let's take climate change. You look at California, the idea that there are millions of people without power for extended periods of time is just astounding. I mean, if this were happening in New York or Washington, D.C., the world would have shut down. But the fact that it's in California, people don't quite realize how serious this is. And so climate change is not an issue that's going to affect our children and grandchildren 50 years ago, although it surely will. It's affecting those people today. The hurricanes that we have been suffering in North Carolina are a direct result of a warming ocean.
They're a crisis, not just climate change.
Exactly.
Right?
So this is real. And we have an administration that is doing everything in its power to undo our government's most effective responses to this crisis, whether it's the Clean Power Plan or the clean car standards. And so what I've done is join with some colleagues and go to court to challenge the administration when it tries to undo these regulations, because they are doing it without complying with the Environmental Protection Act, without complying with the Administrative Procedures Act. So I'm trying to defend what are very sensible and reasonable protections of our natural resources, of our air and our water.
Business even went along with it at certain points. It wasn't like some of these were even that controversial, or at least we'd moved past that point, we thought, with some of these regulations.
They'd baked them into their business plans. Absolutely
right.
Correct.
Yeah.
The Affordable Care Act. There are some Republican attorneys general that are trying to strike down the entire law so that if you have a pre-existing condition, which about 6 or 7 million North Carolinians have, or if you're a senior citizen and benefit from lower drug prices, about 2 million in North Carolina do, or if you're a working person who earns too much for Medicaid but not enough to pay for insurance and get benefit out of the subsidy, which about 600 North Carolinians do, all of that is in jeopardy of being gone because the administration has sided, instead of defending federal law, has sided with these Republican attorneys general to kill the Affordable Care Act. And so I'm in court in Texas trying to defend people's health care. So when they do things that they shouldn't do according to the law, I will stand up to protect the people of the state.
We're coming to the end of your third year in office. Will there be a year 5, 6, 7, 8? Do you anticipate?
Well, there'll certainly be a fourth year. There will be a fourth year. We got a lot of work that we need to keep doing. And I am going to run for reelection. That's good. If the voters hire me again, I will be honored to serve 5, 6, 7, and 8.
Well, we'll be watching that very carefully. We thank you so much for the amazing service you've done to our state. Please keep up the good work, and we'll do this again soon, I hope.
Thanks, Rob.
Coming up next, we'll talk to an attorney who says it's long past time for North Carolina to end the practice of solitary confinement for prisoners. Stay with us.